coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. With summer coming, more people head outdoors, but that brings some risks, including from ticks.
Delaware is one of the top states for Lyme disease incidents. We really just have the perfect climate and the perfect combination of habitats and hosts.
We chat with Denrec tick biologist Ashley Kennedy about how to protect yourself from ticks. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a gentler, greener alternative to pet cremation. Arts Playlist visits a Rehoboth Art League exhibit focused on women. And History Matters examines the local legacy of one of the country's first female landscape architects. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Tick season may be ramping up, but in Delaware, the risk never really goes away. That's according to Ashley Kennedy, tick biologist for Delaware's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control, who says Delaware's mild winters, diverse habitat, and year-round activity are changing how we think about tick exposure. This week, Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari sat down with Kennedy to discuss tick season and how to protect yourself.
Let's start with what the tick season in Delaware looks like. Is there still a tick season in this region, or has this really become a year-round thing?
Unfortunately, we do have ticks year-round in Delaware. My team is actively collecting them every month, even in the middle of winter. But we do still use the term tick season to talk about the late spring continuing into the summer, because that is when the numbers really do go up and people are much more likely to encounter one.
What does peak activity for ticks in Delaware look like, and when is that exactly?
So I would say peak activity is starting to pick up right around now, and it's going to probably continue into June and July. And that's when we see multiple species of ticks that are active at the same time and in much higher numbers, and even different life cycle stages. So basically during the summer in Delaware, you're at risk of encountering more than one kind of tick. It might be a lone star tick, that's the most common one that we have, but the American dog ticks are still active this time of year, and even the black-legged ticks, which are also called deer ticks. Those are the ones that people are probably the most familiar with because they carry a whole laundry list of pathogens.
So Denrec and the CDC have found that Delaware has one of the highest incidences of Lyme disease in the country. First, why is that? And second, is that high rate of Lyme the reason we should be so cautious of ticks? Or is there more to it from your view?
So that's right. Delaware is one of the top states for Lyme disease incidents. We really just have the perfect climate and the perfect combination of habitats and hosts for black-legged ticks, the vector of Lyme disease bacteria. So it's just sort of a perfect storm of, you know, we have lots of mice, we have lots of deer. Those are the most important hosts for those ticks. And then we have a nice mild climate where it doesn't really get too hot or too cold for them. And certainly Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne infection that we have in Delaware, but in some ways it's just the tip of the iceberg, because we know of several other tick-borne pathogens that are circulating here in the state, as well as another condition that's called alpha-gal syndrome, which isn't technically an infection because it's an allergy that occurs following a tick bite. But that you may have heard of, it's called the red meat allergy in some places, because people who develop that condition develop bad reactions after having meat and sometimes dairy products. If it came from a mammal, so that includes, you know, beef, pork, lamb, venison, but poultry and seafood would still be okay.
Is there a type of person, maybe an outdoorsy type, that is at the biggest risk of getting bitten by a tick?
Yeah, and we still don't really know why some people are bigger tick magnets than others. I definitely identify as a tick magnet because I seem to just always be getting them. But certainly people who work or recreate outdoors are going to be at higher risk of encountering one, just because you'll be out in tick habitat. So whether it's, you know, gardening or hiking or even just like walking the dog, you know, those are all activities that might bring you into tick habitat.
And to quickly follow up on that, is there a common area or place like our own backyard or on a hike in the woods where we're most likely to get bitten by a tick?
That's a great question, because I think a lot of people imagine that you're only going to get ticks if you go deep into the woods. But actually, the CDC believes that most people on the East Coast who encounter a tick, it happens in their own yards, just like you were saying. So tick habitat is really a much more broad term than many people realize. So it can include forests, but it can also include grassland habitats like meadows, and then even like wetland environments, wetland habitats. And really the places where ticks thrive the most are going to be edge habitats. So where a forest meets a grassland. So think about like suburban areas where the edges of your yard might come up against a patch of woods. That's going to be really the ideal place for ticks to hang out.
Also, do all tick bites result in infection?
Luckily, no. The odds are in your favor if you're bitten by a tick. Most tick bites do not result in infection, but the risk varies by the tick species and the life stage. So it's really important to know what kind of tick bit you if you do get bitten, because there are some species where I would take their bites much more seriously. So for example, if I was bitten by a black-legged tick, that's a bite I would take much more seriously than a bite from an American dog tick, just because we have, for several years, we've been doing testing. And so we have a lot of data about the relative infection prevalence in each of these different tick species. And we know that the black-legged ticks are much more likely to be infected than the American dog ticks and the Lone Star ticks. And then we know that the older the tick is, so the more exposures it's had, and the greater the likelihood it's going to be infected. So if you're bitten by a larval tick, a tick that just hatched out of the egg, your risk is really slim to nil, because you'll be the first meal that they've ever had. So they haven't had a previous exposure to another animal's blood. Whereas if you're bitten by a nymphal tick, which is kind of the in-between, the teenager stage, they have previously fed once before and you would be their second blood meal. So you would have some risk of exposure. And then your risk is going to be the highest if you're bitten by an adult tick, because you're going to be the third meal, their third possible exposure to an infected bloodstream. So that's when your risk is going to be highest.
You mentioned this earlier, but you recently published the first comprehensive study on ticks in Delaware since 1945 and found that there are at least 15 tick species here in the state, but you're likely to only come across five here. So for the layperson out there, which is most of us when it comes to ticks, how can we spot them or distinguish them from other bugs?
That's a great question. So ticks are arachnids. So they're more closely related to spiders than to insects. So they're going to have 8 legs. That's going to be one of the key features for identifying a tick. And then another thing that makes them different from insects is they're not going to have wings or antennae. So they're just flat-bodied, very small. So you've probably heard them compared to sesame seeds if there's an adult tick, or poppy seeds if they're an immature tick. So very, very tiny. But you don't have to worry about them flying or jumping. They physically can't even do that. So they just crawl very slowly. We are aware of at least 15 tick species that are established here in Delaware. But out of those, there's only 3 that I consider big human biters. So I would say if you get bitten by a tick in Delaware, there's like a 99% chance it's going to be one of the 3 big species that I've mentioned, the Lone Star tick, the American dog tick, or the black-legged tick.
So how can we best protect ourselves from ticks? Where should we start?
Probably the most effective thing you can do is just to apply repellent. And I know everyone's heard that before, and it's really just a matter of putting it into practice and remembering to apply repellent every time you go out into tick habitat. And there's a whole variety of products available, and they're all, and most of them are pretty good. It really comes down to following the directions on the label, because you know, some products are going to be developed to go directly on your skin, and some are going to be developed to go on your clothing or shoes. So just, you know, read the label and see how often you need to apply it and exactly how you need to apply it. And that'll ensure that it's working with the best efficacy and also the most safely. So that would be my number one go-to. And then beyond that, I would say just make sure you're checking for ticks frequently after you've been outdoors, because if you can find that tick before it bites you, that's ideal, because then it won't have any chance to transmit pathogens. But even if it has bitten you, the sooner you can find it and remove it, the better, because the longer it's attached, the more likely it is to transmit a pathogen and make you sick. Dress tick smart just by, tucking your pants into your socks and wearing light colored clothes that make it easier to spot a tick climbing on you, or even just tucking your shirt into your pants. The idea is just to create barriers, make it harder for the tick to find your skin. So anything you can do towards that should help.
If we're bitten, though, what then? What do we do, and how do we remove a tick?
You would want to remove it as soon as possible. So the easiest way is the best way is to just grab a pair of tweezers and you grab that tick as close to your skin as possible, and just get a good grip on it. And you just want to pull it slowly, steadily away from the skin. You know, try not to twist it, try not to jerk it, because you don't want to have part of it break off and be left behind in the skin like a splinter. If that happens, it's not the end of the world. And then wash the bite wound with soap and water or alcohol. And then keep an eye out for symptoms, signs and symptoms of tick-borne disease. And that could include fevers, aches, rashes, even, gastrointestinal upset, feeling nauseous or, feeling like you're going to throw up. And if any of those signs do show up in the weeks following a tick bite, then I would definitely encourage you to reach out to a healthcare professional to talk about next steps.
And I can take this, I know personally, check your dogs too, right? Because they can attract ticks.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Talk to a veterinarian to figure out what's the best method to protect your pet. There's some products that are only for dogs and not for cats, so that's why it's important to get the veterinarian's input, and also just be checking them for ticks too, because no product is going to be like 100% guaranteed to repel every tick. So it's important to check them and remove the ticks promptly.
Thanks to Denrec tick biologist Ashley Kennedy and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We explore a gentler, greener alternative to pet cremation called aquamation and the work going on at the state's first standalone pet aquamation practice. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Saying goodbye to a beloved pet is not easy. Most people turn to cremation through their veterinarian, typically a flame-based process with a heavy environmental footprint. But there's a gentler, greener alternative now called aquamation, a process that uses water, mild heat, and alkali instead of fire. And Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon spoke this week with Chris Philippou, owner of Delaware Pet Aquamation, the state's first standalone pet aquamation practice, about aquamation and the benefits of this alternative process.
Let's start with an explainer on aquamation. Can you walk us through what exactly it is and how it works?
Yeah, of course. So aquamation is a water-based, eco-friendly, and mainly gentle alternative to traditional flame-based cremation that most people know about. So it really became popular maybe within the last decade or two. It's gotten a lot more popular, and it's legal now for human use in about 30 states, I believe. So legal in every state for pets, which is what I offer. So pet aquamation service. And like I said, it's just a really gentle, eco-friendly alternative. It's just a tenth of the carbon footprint as traditional flame-based cremation. So it's a really good alternative for pet owners specifically for what I'm offering.
Right. Well, let's unpack that a bit more in the benefits here. I do know that aquamation doesn't release any harmful emissions that you just alluded to, which says a lot considering more than roughly 350,000 tons of CO2 are emitted every year by this country's pet cremation industry. So, and you just said that this, you just called this a gentler process compared to traditional cremation. So could you expound on that a bit more for us and what makes aquamation such an attractive, you know, alternative as far as the benefits go?
Yeah, so traditional flame-based cremation uses obviously flames and incineration to process the body, specifically the pet for this conversation. Whereas aquamation uses heated water. We heat the water to about 204 degrees, so just below boiling. And we use alkali chemicals, potassium hydroxide, which is found in cosmetic production, soap production, food processing. So it's a pretty common compound. And the water is gently stirred for about 24 hours. And then we're left with just the bones. And the bones get processed into ash. So the process takes a little bit longer than traditional flame-based cremation, but that's what makes it so gentle. So you actually end up with getting 20% more ashes back with aquamation versus traditional flame-based cremation, where some of the bone matter might be incinerated by the flames and the high temps and everything like that. So that's why aquamation is significantly more gentle.
That's so interesting. So then for yourself, you've been in the pet business in Delaware for years as the owner of a dog training company. So, you know, how did you get involved in aquamation and decide to start Delaware Pet Aquamation?
Yeah, so yeah, I was a dog trainer. I had a dog training company for 5-6 years, and my trainer that worked for me, she took over. So the business still lives on, which is cool to see. But I came across aquamation in general, just as a concept, as a process, maybe 3-4 years ago. And then it's always been in the back of my mind. Being in the pet industry, I think it's really important to have really good quality service providers. People who are understanding, empathetic. So I think that's really important qualities to have. So the aquamation process in general has been on my mind for a couple of years. And then things finally came together where the stars aligned and it was good timing to open it up. So I started the process of putting deposits on the machine, equipment, stuff like that at the end of last year. And then finally just opened up about 9-10 weeks ago. So a little over 2 months ago, we finally opened the doors and started working with clients.
Oh, wow. Okay. As far as, let's say I'm interested in going this route with my pet, you know, how's the ball get rolling on this? I'm guessing you have some sort of consult and then what happens from there?
Yeah. So most clients are reaching out just, with a phone call or a text, and we're available 24/7. There's no real convenient time to say goodbye to your pet. So we're available 24/7. By appointment. So people who are either doing their planning, like post-life planning ahead of time before they say goodbye to their pet, or if they had just lost their pet, typically they'll call, they'll get me and we have a conversation about aquamation in general, what I offer, and then some keepsakes that we have, like, you know, the traditional paw prints and paw molds and fur clipping, stuff like that, that we offer just as additional mementos and whatnot. So just schedule an appointment. We meet at the facility and get the process started. So I try and make it as painless and easy as possible, because everyone knows it's not an easy or fun time going through this. So try and be as accommodating as possible for pet owners.
Yeah, and it is a incredibly sensitive space for you to work in and be in, but it sounds like Delaware Pet Aquamation checks the boxes in all those ways. I am curious, is there a kind of pet or some sort of like size restriction, whatever, that doesn't qualify for something like this?
That's a great question. So we could do anywhere down to, you know, even a goldfish or anything, you know, the smallest animal, like pet mouse, pet rat. We've done guinea pigs, bearded dragons. So we've done some pretty small animals. And then in terms of size restriction, we could do any dog breed. And then we can even start getting into like small farm animals, probably. So I would say probably 400 or 500 pound weight limit is what we could handle. So we could handle quite a bit.
There's a lot to like about this process then, I'd say, and the work you're doing with Delaware Pet Aquamation. But, you know, as a concept, this is relatively new territory, I'm sure, for a lot of folks out there, a lot of listeners. I guess when it comes to any concerns or questions, what have you heard from people regarding those? Is there a common thread or any sentiments that you usually hear from folks who are interested but maybe a little hesitant about exploring aquamation?
Yeah, I think hesitancy isn't super common, but it definitely exists. And I think that's a better word to use than like skepticism. There's definitely some clients who have never heard of aquamation and need to be educated on it. And we need to share all the steps, the procedures, why we're different, why I think it's better, not just for the pets, but also for the plant and the environment. So there's definitely very valid curiosity, hesitancy, I guess you could say, with aquamation because it's so new. And, you know, even a lot of vets have never heard about it. So there's definitely a big component to starting this business where I need to really focus efforts on educating, providing information, and then giving clients all the tools they need to make the decision that's best for them. So there's not really a right or wrong answer, you know, whether flame-based cremation is better or aquamation is better. I think it's really important that I give all the information to the pet owner and then they can ultimately decide what they'd like to do. But I think once people get all the information, do a little bit of reading online, read my website, I think they come to the realization that it is a really nice option, a really nice alternative. It's great for the planet. And I think it's just an all-around gentler process, which everyone wants for their pet.
Yeah, I'd say at the very least, it's nice having an option that especially is environmentally friendly and is like we keep saying, gentler and non-aggressive, just to have that as an other option compared to what, you know, we kind of traditionally get funneled towards using. Again, one more question here as far as the nitty gritty goes. Again, I can assume that various contributing factors here, but what does cost look like? Or does that really depend on the kind of pet, the kind of animal?
It's strictly based on weight, pretty much. And we have a broad weight ranges to make it kind of easy. And we've also published all of our pricing on our website for transparency. I think it's kind of overwhelming at times during this part of, you know, human's life, dealing with the loss of a pet, where some people just don't want to talk to somebody over the phone just to get pricing. So I've tried to make it super easy. So all my pricing is published to my website. And for example, pets under 10 pounds is $150. And then from 10 pounds to 50 pounds is $200. So I think it's extremely comparable to traditional flame-based cremation. I've heard some clients tell me my pricing is even better than some. It's an interesting place to be in price-wise, because I think there's oftentimes a premium that companies charge specifically for being labeled as eco-friendly or green. I don't really feel like it's right or justified to say, hey, just because we're eco-friendly, we should charge more. So I've done a lot of research, both regionally and nationally, to try and gauge pricing. And I think I've done a good job at being kind of right in the middle at affordable and not overpriced or anything like that.
Absolutely. And again, it just kind of goes lockstep in how you're kind of running Delaware Pet Aquamation as a whole, just a very thoughtful approach in all these areas. So what's your hope then or end goal with Aquamation at the Delaware Pet, at Delaware Pet Aquamation going forward? What does that, whether your hope or your goal, whatever it may be, what does that look like for you as you go forward with all this?
It's a great question. My hope is that there's no hesitancy in the next like year or two. My goal is that every single person who owns a pet knows that this is an option, whether they use me, somebody else. You know, I just want to make sure that everyone is aware that aquamation exists for pet owners. And then long-term goal, I would love to see aquamation be legalized in Delaware specifically for humans as well. So I think it's such a great alternative, and hopefully we're one of the next few states that becomes legalized in.
Thanks to Delaware pet aquamation owner Chris Philippou and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist and a trip to the Rehoboth Art League for a look at a new exhibit that explores the question, what about the women? You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A new exhibition at the Rehoboth Art League asks a simple but powerful question. What about the women? That's the title of Rehoboth-based artist Kim Klaibe's latest show, which features a deeply personal collection of mixed-media works exploring the stories, struggles, and strength of women across generations. Through layered materials like watercolor, charcoal, rice paper, and house paint, Klaibe captures what it means to be broken, rebuilt, and still standing. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny catches up with Klaibe for a closer look at the themes behind her work and the emotions she hopes to evoke through her art.
Tell me about your artistic journey so far and how you've gotten to this point.
Oh, my. My artistic journey has been a lifetime journey. I've been an artist as long as I can remember. The artwork that I've enjoyed has ranged from a lot of drawing when I was a little girl, lots and lots of drawing. I can remember sitting in church with my family, and people sit pretty still in church, so I like to draw them while they were sitting still. So I got a lot of practice drawing the back of people's heads. So I did a lot of that as a kid, and then I went to art school. Much to my parents' chagrin, they were not interested in me being an artist at all. They thought I'd starve, and, at times they were right about that. So art school kind of introduced me to a lot of different types of art, and I learned more about how to paint and, all the things that you learn in school. And so from there, I had been a watercolorist, I worked in acrylics. I did theater sets. Then I went to, it was in 2017. Actually, I remember that very well. I started experimenting with wine and beer and not drinking it, but using it as an art medium. So I would pour wine and beer onto a surface and let it move around, let it dry, and then look at it and find the shapes that were hidden in the wine and beer and begin to make those shapes into pretty elaborate kind of illustrations. And then recently I got into more of a mixed media, which is what is hanging at the Art League right now. So I've dabbled in a lot of different things.
You mentioned your work is mixed media, and certainly that adds a lot of texture to the work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the different materials that go into the paintings that are on display and what they add to the work.
Lately, I've been throwing the kitchen sink at the paintings. The type of work I'm doing now starts with a wood panel, and then I cover the wood panel with rice paper. I adhere it with a archival type of adhesive, and I kind of crinkle the rice paper to give it some texture and creases, which makes it kind of interesting. And then from there, there's charcoal, there's pastel, there's basic acrylic paint, there's house paint, there's Conte crayon, cut paper. I've used things like old flip-flops around the house, painted the bottom of them, and used those for texture. So yeah, it's very experimental. It's fun. It's interesting because it's experimental, and what happens if I do this? what happens if I spray water right here on the, what if I put tissue paper on it and then spray water on it? Well, okay, well, that creates kind of a translucent layer, and I can see the layers underneath of it. So that's the process I'm in now, which is very, it's very invigorating. It's exciting. And I don't always do the same thing twice. Every time I do something, it's something new.
It sounds like it's more intuitive than analytical when you're looking at the wood and adding layers.
Yeah, it definitely is. It is very intuitive. I'm kind of in my own little world when I'm doing that, and lose all track of time. And I think that's because I don't even know how to describe that feeling, but it is it's kind of almost like a spiritual kind of thing. It just kind of takes over, and I'm grabbing whatever, and next thing I know, 4 or 5 hours have passed and I have to take a break.
One thing that really struck me about your work is how evocative the titles are. Misogyny, DEI hire, in the red. Do you start with a title, or does the title emerge as you're putting the work together?
The title emerges because since 2017, when I was doing the wine and beer pours, and I was doing those as a reaction to current events in 2017. And since then, many of my titles or subjects have been influenced heavily by current events. So while I'm working on a piece, I may, many times I have podcasts or music with news interludes playing in the background, and something will enter my ear. And it's got to be something that moves me in a certain way. So if I hear something like, you know, the whole DEI thing, for example, that invoked a lot of feeling in me. And so I was working on, you know, the recent show I've done right now is called What About the Women? So every subject in this show is a woman, because I do think that there's a lot of, it's not just about women, obviously, what's happening in the world, but a lot of what's happening in the world, particularly in the United States, is affecting women. And so I just started thinking about that particular topic when I was working on that piece. And the woman in that piece is, you know, there's some ethnic qualities about that woman. And so I just started kind of making that connection. But it's also, those titles also for me capture a moment in time. This is what was happening at this moment when I painted this painting. So like misogyny, I painted a woman with a big smile wearing a gold foil crown. And ever since I was a little girl, the beauty pageants, I was always bothered by them. And I wasn't sure as a little girl why I was bothered by them. It just, parading the women out in their bathing suits kind of made me think about, like, I don't know, cattle. What are we doing? You know, why are we parading these women around? So that title, the misogyny, is M-I-S-S, no, hyphen. But I do think that there, and of course, this is just my opinion, but I do think there is a little bit of that in that type of exploitation of women.
Yeah, and you know, then, okay, now show us your talent, your singular talent.
Yeah, and it will watch you twirl the baton.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that you're in the studio working, and you've still got this sort of connection to the larger world around you, and sort of that's feeding your work. I think that's really an interesting thing. And I wanted to follow up on that a little bit too, because your work is so socially relevant right now. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on the importance of art at this moment right now in America.
I think art during this time is very important for the artist, because when you're an artist expressing yourself in this way, it's almost like you're laying your soul bare. You're putting yourself out there, and it can be very nerve-wracking when that show is hanging and you feel kind of like, all right, well, that's all my innermost thoughts that are hanging there, and you don't know how people will react to it. Some people don't react well. They may have some negative things to say because it could be inspired by a title that makes somebody upset, or it could be the subject of the painting, whatever, it can upset people. But I do think that's important to make sure that expression is still being expressed. It's important for the artist. And I think the people that I know that have gone to see this particular show at the Art League have come up to me, and I had this one woman come up to me, and she was very emotional. She just kept saying, thank you for doing this show, and telling me about how much it means to her, and how important it is to highlight this particular topic. So I think art for the general population during a time of uncertainty is a way to reach people. It's a way for people to find connection and kind of a safe place to go, to be able to look at something, feel something, look at that painting, feel it, understand it, make your own personal connection with that art, and maybe walk away with a feeling of peace, or a feeling like, okay, I just found something that touched me, and that's a beautiful thing. That's kind of my way of thinking about why art is so important.
Thanks to Rehoboth-based artist Kim Klaibe and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this latest edition of Arts Playlist. Klaibe's What About the Women exhibit is on view at the Rehoboth Art League through June 8th. And we finish out the green next with History Matters, where we learn more about one of the country's first female landscape architects, Marion Coffin, and her lasting impact on Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The University of Delaware was founded, built, and attended, at least for its first 140 years, by men. But it was Marion Coffin, one of the country's first female landscape architects, who designed the entire look and feel of UD's campus. Coffin left a lasting impression on both the university and the rest of Delaware. Her landscape designs and works include the Mount Cuba Center, the gardens at Winterthur Museum, and the grounds at Gibraltar Mansion. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Anna Wick, UD Associate Professor of Landscape Architecture and board member of the nonprofit Preservation Delaware, to discuss Coffin's career and her indelible impact on the First State.
Marion Coffin was a trailblazer in landscape architecture, but do we know what drew her to that field in the first place?
Thanks, Kyle. That's a great question. Marion Coffin had a really interesting trajectory to become a landscape architect. She was born into privilege in 1876, but she wasn't really super wealthy herself. I kind of think of her as super rich adjacent. Her mother was actually a bridesmaid at Henry Algernon DuPont's wedding, and his son, Henry Francis DuPont, of course, had a longstanding relationship with Marion Coffin in building out the gardens at Winterthur. So she traveled in those elite circles. Because of that, traveling and living in these like beautiful spaces around wealthy people and with beautiful gardens, she was exposed to landscape at an early age. And she grew up at a time when women didn't have a lot of opportunities to get into the professional world. But in her writing, she talks about how she was always interested in the arts. She felt called to a profession in something, but she didn't feel that she was quite artsy enough to be a painter or a sculptor. And she had been hearing about this new emerging field of landscape architecture. She was certainly aware of Beatrix Jones, later known as Beatrix Jones Ferrand, who was another important woman in landscape architecture. And she decided that that was a path she wanted to pursue as a landscape architect. So those were kind of what got her interested in what landscape architecture and what it could be. She was also quite well-traveled and so would have been exposed to beautiful neoclassical landscapes in Europe, as well as more contemporary Gilded Age landscapes in the United States.
Yeah, a trailblazer indeed. Something you mentioned there as far as, you know, the time period that she's doing all this in, can you give us, you know, personally, and I'm sure our listeners can imagine the challenges and the obstacles that Marion faced given that time period, but could you kind of paint us a picture, or at least give us an idea of the kinds of barriers that she had to overcome, you know, as one of the first women in landscape architecture?
Absolutely. So when Coffin decided at around the age of 24 that she wanted to attend the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to pursue this passion, she was very excited and gung-ho. But they kind of said, well, wait a minute, what kind of training do you have? What are you bringing to the table? And like many other women at that time, she had not had any formal education up to that point. She had been schooled at home. And so initially, she was actually refused entry. Because of her passion for the field, she was able to, and I would say her passion for the field, as well as maybe her elite status, she was able to pull some strings, and after working with the tutor extensively to get her math skills up to par, was admitted as a special student in the landscape architecture program. So I'd say one thing was that she just didn't have, she sort of was coming to the field with less training than others who were pursuing a similar thing, who weren't women. Another thing that she was up against was the fact that she was one of only four women in her class at MIT. Two were studying architecture, two were studying landscape architecture. And so there was sort of a need for the men in the program to kind of get used to having women around in this already sort of new field of landscape architecture, and then having new people around. But she does indicate in her writings that there was a sense of camaraderie that she felt with all of the men in her program and with the faculty, et cetera. After graduation, she was up against even a larger challenge, which was that landscape architecture was still relatively new. So people didn't know quite what to make of that. And as a woman, they didn't have a lot of faith that she would be able to oversee installations and make sure that things were being done as they were intended. People were reticent to hire a woman as a entry-level landscape architect because they felt that they wouldn't get a lot of respect out in the field. Because of this, Coffin was even more trailblazing, and she said, I'm going to just, as they say, hang out her own shingle or set up her own shop. And she did that and ultimately ended up employing lots of other women in landscape architecture, as well as men. But I think that those are two things that she had to deal with. Finally, on the personal side of things, I would say that this probably impacted her as far as having a long-term family or partner. She never did marry, and it was kind of said around the time that going to university was sort of matrimonial suicide for women. That didn't seem to matter to her. She really treated her career and her profession as the thing that gave her the most pride and joy. And I think this is something that many can look at today, those who choose not to have a family, but instead have other types of children that they are kind of nurturing, which her profession was.
Yes, and that's honestly, all of that's pretty remarkable, amazing, really, and how she brought other women along with her, essentially, given the time, and, you know, wasn't a gatekeeper in that sense. And well, let's start with, you know, at least let's take a look then here at some of her biggest or bigger projects in Delaware. We know she helped craft and shape the, you know, University of Delaware's campus. Can you tell us more about her work in that, and, you know, how her vision might be still visible today?
Sure. So Coffin was the UD landscape architect from 1918 to 1952. And I think that alone is pretty incredible that she was the commissioned as the sole landscape architect as a woman at that time period. This commission came about because she had those close relationships with Hugh Rodney Sharp, who was the chairman of Buildings and Grounds. She had also done work for Lamont, DuPont, and Henry Francis DuPont, also on the board of the University of Delaware, which was then known as Delaware College. So they knew her through their private lives and through work she had done with them and brought her on. At UD, the esteemed architectural firm of Day & Clauter had already come up with a general framework for the campus of where buildings would be, and they were committed to building in the Georgian style. So they did lots of field trips around the state of Delaware looking at other examples, like the Corbett Sharp House and other houses that had that real Georgian architecture. But Coffin was tasked with coming up with a long-term vision for what that landscape would look like. And so in July of 1919, she came up with what is called the General Plan for Layout. And this is visible at UD in the archives. You can find it online, as well as I think Winterthur has a copy as well. And in this, she created a large-scale framework for how the campus would develop over time. She was very thoughtful about circulation through these spaces and creating different types of spaces that people could come together in. So all of her work is sort of marked by this understanding of the transitions between spaces and how important circulation is and the scale of spaces that you create. And so she gave a lot of thought to where men and women would gather, where places would be just for men to be outside of their dormitories, what the landscape would look like on the south end of campus versus the north end. Again, she continually asserted that she should have final rights to any changes that would happen in the landscape. Another thing to think about both UD and all of the landscapes that she worked in is the way she used plants was very strategic, very thoughtful. She understood the architectural nature of plants and the formal nature that they could provide, but also thought a lot about how they change over time and how they could soften and create sort of a romantic feel. Color theory was very important to all landscape architects at the time that she was practicing. A lot of them were informed by Gertrude Jekyll's work in England, but really thinking about how the colors changed over the seasons was super important to her, both at UD and in some of the other gardens that she designed in Delaware and beyond. And she actually selected plants based on the sort of feeling of the space she was trying to create. She was trying to be intentional about the way these spaces felt based on who they were being designed for.
We know Marion's landscape designs and works also include the Mount Cuba Center, the gardens at Winterthur Museum, and the grounds at Gibraltar Mansion. What else, as far as her work goes, beyond Delaware, you know, what should we know? What stands out there for you, at least broadly speaking?
So Coffin did a lot of work in Delaware, and because I live in Delaware and work at UD, I am, you know, think of her as a Delaware landscape architect. But in truth, she really worked all up and down the Eastern Seaboard for some of the biggest names of the early 20th century, as I mentioned, Marjorie Merriweather Post and Marshall Field and the DuPonts. She did designs in Kentucky and Connecticut and New Jersey, New York, all over. And I don't think that we recognize or she is recognized enough for the breadth of work that she did at that time as a pioneering woman in the field of landscape architecture. She also lifted other young women entering the field of landscape architecture up. She provided jobs and helped them succeed in a field that was still dominated by men. She is starting to have a resurgence. People are starting to see her work more. And I think that we can continue to lift it up and make sure that we're showcasing how well her work stands up over time. And I think that really speaks to her, the importance of her is that these places that she designed, they can have times when they're sort of left to their own devices and get overgrown and things need to be kind of cleaned up and cleared away. And yet the bones remain and the spaces still feel beautiful. And she has really given us a like framework that can be come back to, you know, years and years after the initial design. I think she was also a committed and loyal friend and colleague. And we see this through her long-term relationships with her clients. Today, we might think of landscape architecture as being more involved in the public realm, but I think that those relationships still must be strong, must be reciprocal, and must have sort of this give and take. So these conversations with clients, not thinking of yourself as the person who's telling someone what has to be done, but more so having a conversation about what the goals of the landscape are. And I think that that made her work super successful.
Thanks to UD Professor Anna Wick and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that brings us to the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari and Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.